Welcome to PM Lessons Learned, a podcast for project managers, helping project managers by sharing lessons learned. Increase your PM knowledge, build business relationships, increase your effectiveness, increase your marketability, gain professional support. Join our group and take part in our conference calls. Details at pmlessonslearned.com.
Hello, and welcome to the PM Lessons Learned monthly PMP Exams Data Group Conference Call and Podcast. This is podcast number 123. We are recording this session on the 2nd of June, 2011, and we are totally focused on version 4 of the PMBOK Guide. My name is Dana Safford. I'm your host for the PM Lessons Learned monthly PMP Exam Study Group Conference Call. I've been a PMP since version 2 of the PMBOK. I'm also a certified ITIL version 3 expert and a Microsoft certified systems engineer. I have over 25 years of project management experience in the IT industry. I work for Hewlett-Packard as a complex problem manager, and in this role, I take a very complex situation that is affecting an HP customer's enterprise production environment, and I manage a project with a virtual technical team from around the world that quickly resolves the issue. So remember, you don't have to have the term project manager in your job title to actually be a project manager. Our presenter for this session is me, and our topic is, so you want to be a PMP. So you've been thinking about it for a long time. You've even started gathering some information, collecting stuff. Well, what are you going to do? What do you really need to collect? How long will it take you to succeed? What do you have to do? All those types of things. This month's PM Lessons Learned PMP Exam Study Group Call helps to set your stage for implementing the commitment that will significantly enhance your career. I will provide insight and practical examples of everything you need to know to begin the process of preparing the application and building your critical knowledge mass that will allow you to pass the PMP exam on the first attempt. If you haven't already downloaded a PDF copy of this session's presentation, please do so. If you are in the livefreec.com virtual meeting room, the file is in the lobby. To find out how to download the files and podcasts for all the PM Lessons Learned session, you could go to www.pmlessonslearned.com, and in the left-hand navigation column, you'll see a link to files and presentations. Just follow that link, and you will end up with the PDF files for this session. The file name for this session is PMLL, so you want to be a PMP, with the date of June 2nd, 2011. And its title is the same thing, PMLL, so you want to be a PMP, to June 11. In the file area, you'll also see the content from the last couple of years' worth of conference calls for the monthly PMP exam study group. And there's an updated PMBOK version 4 brain dump in there as well. If you look around in the past monthly PMP exam study group calls folder, you'll find some other files that have been around for a while as well. We cleaned out most of the stuff that is version 3 based, version 3 of the PMBOK guide. That's kind of old and we don't want to go too far along with version 3 anymore. And also if you're looking around on the internet is a very big place. If you choose to use material from another source, make sure you know it's PMBOK based. You want material based on version 4. Especially all the folks for this session, version 4 is the version you want to pay attention to. You should remember there's roughly a 30% difference from version 3 to version 4, and it's pretty much all in the processes in their ITTOs or inputs, tools and techniques, and outputs. So just be aware of what you pick up. People will sell you anything nowadays, and if you're going to plunk down some money especially, you want to make sure you're getting something that's current. So don't put down anything if it's version 3 related, because it really isn't going to help you. There's plenty of version 4 stuff out there, both free and otherwise. Finally, this is the PM Lessons Learned monthly PMP Exam Study Group Conference Call and Podcast. If you are on a shorter time scale and are willing to make an active commitment, then participate and take turns presenting study group material, our weekly PMP exam study group might be the right place for you. For more information on that, send an email off to pmpstudy@pmlessonslearned.com, and someone will get back to you. So, we are pmlessonslearned.com, project managers helping project managers to make a difference. I'll thank you in advance for those participating in this month's live conference call and for those who download and use the podcast. So, let's get started. I'm going to shift over to the slide deck now, and what you're looking at is slide number 1. It's our standard slide that lets everybody know what calls we have. This being the first Thursday of the month, we are on our PMP study group conference call. Then on the second Thursday of the month, we have our PM Lessons Learned Job Shop call, And that's where people who are in transition and want help with job searching, resumes, or whatever can go for help there. On the third Thursday of each month, we have our PM Lessons Learned Best Practices call. And that is where our founder, Henry Will, brings in practitioners who do presentations on an array of project management topics and such. If you want to listen to any of our calls or download the podcast, you can go to www.pmlessonslearned.com. And then at the left-hand navigation column, find out where to go to get all those things. And if you haven't yet, try joining our Yahoo and LinkedIn groups. We're starting to get a bit active, and you can find out some good information from there as well. Moving on to the next slide, we'll talk about our call norms. I'd like this to be an interactive call, if we can do that. I'd love you to participate, ask me a question, whatever, but I've muted all your phones. So in order to ask me a question, you must do a star 6 to unmute your phone, get my attention somehow so that you can ask your question. I'll stop talking. You can start once I recognize you. And then we'll go back and forth a little bit and some interaction. And then once that's done, I'll ask you to do a star 6 to remute your phone so we don't get into background noise and such. And we'll carry on that way. All right, moving on to the next slide is our email address, pmpstudy@pmlessonslearned.com, like I mentioned before. Anything you want to do, we're always looking for volunteers. If you want to give back to the community, the project management community, we're always looking for folks to do things. So send us an email and someone will get back to you. Moving on to the next slide, here's our title slide for the session, So You Want to Be a PMP, and today is June 2nd, 2011. I'll move on to the next slide, and these are the things we'll be talking about as far as PMP certification. We'll talk about what it is, why it is important to various folks, how do you become certified, what the steps you have to do are, and things along those lines. I'll give you some reference materials to get you started, but as I said, there's plenty of information out there on the various things you have to do to become a PMP, so be careful of those things. But I'll give you some links that we've checked out, and they're very safe. And then at the end, we'll let you know how to stay certified, because once you pass the test, you'll have to be recertified every now and again, every 3 years, and we'll give you a hint on how to do that as well. Moving on to the next slide, we'll begin to talk about PMP certification and just what is it? Well, it is a demonstration, a certification, as opposed to a certificate. A lot of people get certificates confused with certifications. A certificate is something you receive from a university, from a school, saying you've passed X number of classes. So you sat through the classes, you've done whatever you need to put back to them to show you know the material, so you get a project management certificate. That is not a certification. That's just sort of like a diploma, but certificates tend to be for shorter periods of time. Where a certification is you have to show how to apply that knowledge that you've built up, either from classroom knowledge, institutional knowledge, and practical knowledge from actually being a project manager. And that's what the PMP is all about. You're going to take that project management leadership knowledge and then experience, and you're going to do something with it. You take a test, and that shows to other people around the world that you at least have a certain level of knowledge, a certain level of experience. Now, are you going to be the best project manager going for having a PMP? Well, that depends on you. It all depends on what you do with all of these things, whether you have a PMP or not. You can be a great project manager and not have a PMP. You can be a PMP and be a lousy project manager. It all depends on you. So just sort of pay attention to that. This is a certification for project management. It's recognized around the world, as I said, in all major industries. There's even various factions of the body of knowledge for construction, for communications, for IT, for a bunch of different things. So it's not just an information technology certification. It can be applied across a whole lot of different industries. If you receive a PMP, that means you are certified by the Project Management Institute, or the PMI, as a project management professional. That's the official name. PMI has other certifications out there. As you can see through the list, besides the PMP, they have an associate one, CAPM. That's really for people who have been project team members, not really project leaders. So if you're just getting started, you can become a CAPM. It's almost the same study process. The difference is that the test is shorter. It's a 100-question test, and at the end of 3 years, you have to retest over again. There's no recertification by PDUs. It's a test every 3 years, and you'll take whatever the current test happens to be. But it's for somebody who's just getting started in project management as a team member. that's also a program manager certification. That takes a whole lot more than a PMP, because now they're going to look a whole lot more at your experience levels, what you're capable of doing, things along those lines. There's a whole lot more to the application, and it takes a lot longer to get through. But there are a lot of certified program managers out there as well. And there are also scheduling and risk management certifications now as well. There's enough specialization in those areas that the PMI has come out with a certification. And while it's not on this list yet, there will be an Agile certification as well. They haven't fully released it yet, so it's not on the slide, but they'll be coming out with one of those. And that'll be an interesting one to take a look at, because if folks know what Agile is, because things change all the time, there's a moving target. And how they're going to do a certification on a moving target is going to be kind of interesting to watch, but we'll see what happens as time goes on. Moving on to the next slide, there are other certification entities out there. All that certifies is not the PMI. The PMI is not the only game in town. Besides the PMI, if you happen to be over in Europe, they have one that tends to be more prevalent over there called PRINCE, and it's an acronym for Projects in Controlled Environments, and it's a second version, so they call it PRINCE too. There's also a Project Plus certification put out by CompTIA, or another one that's beginning to gain a whole lot more popularity is the International Project Management Association certification, or IPMA. That one is pretty much experience-based. They have examinations to a great extent, but it's more an interview process that you'll go through. So it is a bit more stringent, if you will, I think, than the PMP certification from the PMI. But it is out there, and there are numerous people who have both. There's no reason why you can't have all of these if you want to. Nothing is stopping you. It depends on how much alphabet soup you want after your name. Sort of like a lot of people out there. So consider those if you want. This presentation is only going to focus on the PMP certification from the PMI, though, because that's our main focus here on this conference call and on these podcasts. So I'm going to move to the next slide and talk about why a PMP certification is important. And it has two levels to it. It's really important to you because this is a big piece of career development for you. This is a major stepping stone in your career. This shows other people that you have the tenacity to stick with something, to learn a framework, to learn all the buzzwords, to learn all the processes, to learn all the theories, all the formulas, all this other stuff that's in the project management body of knowledge, and you've been able to parrot it back out in an exam that shows you at least have a certain base level of knowledge that you can then take and go any place with that. It gives you the professional recognition that you would perhaps crave. It gives you a validation of project management experience and education, as I mentioned before, because you'll see what those minimum thresholds are in a moment. And it'll increase your confidence because now you're able to show that you're able to do something. And if you look at some of the salary surveys out there, it'll increase your value. Because now if you have those three little letters next to your name, you'll be able to maybe garner a higher salary or even a job for that matter. Because a lot of times now in this day and age, this flat world where there's a single job opening and 5,000 people apply, well, how do they screen through that initial batch of 5,000 people? They look for things like a PMP after your name. If it's a project management job. So it helps to get you through some knot holes, if you will, that you would not necessarily otherwise make it through, depending upon how any company or any organization does their screening. Some will actually read the resume and it won't matter. Others, not so much. And if you don't have those PMP letters after your name, you don't get through the initial screen. So just sort of be aware of that. That's how it helps you out. It helps your company or organization out because now they can tout the fact that they have PMPs working for them. I work for Hewlett-Packard. We routinely show that we have X number of PMPs, X number of Microsoft-certified engineers, X number of ITIL-certified experts. That's marketing for your organization that they can use. It could give them a competitive edge. In a lot of instances, if they're competing, and again, in this flat world, it's not only people that are competing, but companies are as well. It becomes a necessary prerequisite in a lot of cases for some customers. They want to see how many certified beings do you have, and those certifications can be across any type of industry, any type of job. There isn't just project management certifications. There's nursing certifications, teaching certifications, piloting certifications, all kinds of different things. So any certification is an important stepping stone. And it also helps in employee development because depending on what organization you're in, they might actually pay for this. A lot of companies don't, but if your company does, if your organization pays for it, it really helps you out, because then you can get some better quality classes, better quality materials, that if you were shelling it out of your own pocket, which a lot of you are doing, I'm sure, your finances are limited to a great extent, and you can't build up that wealth of information. Moving on to the next slide. So as I mentioned earlier, a P&P certification does not make a good project manager. If you're a crappy project manager before certification, you're probably going to be a crappy one after you're done as well. It's up to you to take that extra step, improve yourself. But if you are a good project manager already, having a P&P certification or any of those other ones can make you a better project manager, because now you've got a framework that you can use where maybe you weren't aware of a framework before that was applicable across your industry, whatever it might be. So if there's a good stepping stone, a good way to make sure you are improving yourself, there's a better way to say that. Let's move on to the next slide. Get into some of the meat and what's going on. How do you become certified is what we'll be talking about. It's a combination of education and experience. Candidates must have a minimum combination of education and project management experience. We'll get into those numbers in a moment. You must agree to adhere to a code of professional conduct. You download that from their site, you read it, and on the application is a checkbox that says, yes, I agree to be bound by this code. It's not a huge deal, because it's basically like the golden rule. Do unto others as you would have them do unto you. You don't do things necessarily that are going to hurt other people. You don't do things that are unethical. You have a certain amount of social responsibility to go through. It's nothing outrageous if you're an above boards type of person. So don't worry about it so much. Then you have to fill out an application that includes your experience and your education that may or may not be audited. We'll get into that in a moment as well. And then finally, you take an exam. There's a sit-down exam, either on a computer or on a piece of paper, depending upon what part of the world you're in. Some places still are doing paper tests, while most of the world is doing computer-based. It's a four-hour, 200-question, multiple-choice exam, four choices per question. Moving on to the next slide. So what do you have to do? Your combination of education and experience will vary depending upon how much higher education you have, if you will. There are two categories. The first category is for folks who have a bachelor's degree in the U.S. or the equivalent global university equivalent to that. That shows they've got the base level college education is one way to say that. And if you have that base level college education, then you have to show 4,500 project hours that span a three-year time period over a six-year horizon. Right? So over the last 6 years, you have to not only come up with 4,500 individual hours, how many hours you spent on each individual project, but because they don't want everything to be glumped up at the end or smooshed up against the last 2 months before you put out your application, they want that over 3 years. So they want to see over that six-year period, people don't necessarily work full-time jobs. There are contract gigs and whatever. So you might be working for 6 months, not working for three, back on job for a year, and been off for one, that type of thing. So over that horizon, they want to see 36 months or 3 years worth of activity that encompasses a total of at least 4,500 hours. That's the experience piece of it. And then as far as education goes, they'd like you to have 35 contact hours of training. Now, what's a contact hour? Contact hour is sitting for a class for an hour. You need 35 of those. If you were to go to a one-week class on project management put on by any of the registered education providers, that would be 40 contact hours for the most part. You went 8 hours a day, 5 days a week. Most of them are a little bit less than that, but you get the point. If you're in front of them for 8 hours a day, 5 days a week, that's 40 contact hours. And you can amass those. So in theory, even a single week-long project management class would yield you enough hours for the application. All right? So, but you can put in a whole lot more. You should put in a whole lot more in your application than just the 35 hours. Same with your experience. Don't stop at just 4,500 hours, because as you justify any of these, be it education or be it experience, the PMI could audit you. If they audit you, they're going to want to check to see if what you've told them is valid. And there may be something that you think is relevant that they might not. So if you're just at 35 contact hours or just at 4,500 hours and they lop something off, you could be short, if you will. You could not have the minimum time. So put in a whole lot. With my PMP application, I had, I think, 165 contact hours because I had numerous week-long classes. I have a project management certificate. So I took every single class that I went through for that project management certificate, and that's in my application, 165 hours worth. And the same for experience. For the experience level, put in 10,000 hours. It doesn't matter. You have to fill out a form for each project. I'll get into that in a little while. But put in a whole lot extra so that if you are audited and they decide to chop some off, you're still going to be fine. It won't matter. Now, looking at Category 2 on the right-hand side of the table here, this is for folks who don't have a college degree. They don't have that advanced degree. The folks like that could still make perfectly good project managers. In fact, some of the best project managers have no college degree. It depends on how you apply yourself. So don't think you have to have a college degree to be a PMP. You don't. But what you have to have, if you don't have the college degree, you have to have a bit more time in experience level. It jumps from 4,500 hours if you have a degree to 7,500 hours if you don't. And they've expanded the time frame from 36 consecutive months to 60 consecutive months over that 8-year horizon. And the contact hours is the same. One point I want to bring up about contact hours as well, if you look through advertisements for various pieces of training, they'll almost always say, well, we give PDUs for that, professional development units. Professional development units, remember, though, are meant for people who are already PMP certified to maintain their certification. Unfortunately, a PDU does not necessarily equate to a contact hour. There are courses out there that will offer PDUs but do not offer contact hours. So if you're going to sign up for any type of training, look for the words contact hours. If you don't see it, talk to somebody, talk to a human, and ask them about contact hours. They should be familiar with the question. But it drives me crazy that they'll put in PDUs, that the thing's available for PDUs, but not available for contact hours. Make sure you explicitly find that out. And any one of these expensive $5,000, $10,000 classes, I'm sure will give you the contact hours, the direct hours, but some of the other online or virtual things may not. So pay attention to that and make sure you don't waste your time thinking you've got a contact hour. You submit your application and the PMI says, oh, gee, no, that class that you spent $2,000 for doesn't offer contact hours. They offer PDUs instead. That would be a bad thing, I would say. So check it up front before you plunk down any money. Okay, moving on to the next slide. So let's get into a bit more of the application and what you have to put together. There is an online application. Definitely take the time to do the application online. Don't do it in a piece of paper. Whip out your computer tools, Notepad, Google Documents, Microsoft Word, any of those types of things, and start building up a file, building up a document that lists your projects, a description of the project, who the contact people are. Once you see the application, download a copy of the application, look through the PMP handbook. You'll see what you have to develop. You see them on the slide here, who the employer is, the project start and stop dates, all those pieces of material there, the project title, your role, a contact, number of hours, and a summary of the project task that you led. Remember, this is for project leadership. Now, that last sub-bullet down there, summary of the project task, they're not looking for it in the encyclopedia. You have 500 characters in order to say what that project was. So you can be pretty broad. You can be very broad. With my application, since I work a lot of shorter-term projects, a lot of shorter-term customer satisfaction type of things. The customer is busted, and I form a project team to go fix it. A lot of what I had in the front of mine were exactly the same. In this project, I led a virtual team of technical experts. So there's, 100 characters right there almost, and then I spent 400 characters describing the uniqueness of that project. So you can do a lot of duplication in these things, and I think you should. And at the very end, you can start saying what was different about that one project. You keep that in an online file, Google Docs, Word, whatever, and just copy and paste as you're working your way through. And build this up, one for each project, so that by the time it comes ready to do your application, you're just going to be copying from the document, pasting into the application. Copy, paste, copy, paste, copy, paste. and it goes a whole lot faster. Then if you happen to have a network hiccup, because who knows, your ISP might decide to have a hiccup or your system might die or whatever, you haven't lost anything. You don't want to spend X number, 10, 20 hours building up all this stuff only to lose it. So keep it someplace, keep a backup copy of it until your application is fully submitted. It'll save you a whole lot of time and aggravation. Also on the application is a section on education. You'll be one piece of the form for each class for each education provider. So if you have a project management certificate, there'll be a place on there for each class from that education provider. Later on, you'll see some of the value ways to do things. If you use PM PrepCast for your education provider, you'll use one of the sections of the form for that. You can have any number of education things, 15 or 20 if you want. Get it up over 35 hours in case anything's audited. And then at some point in time, you'll need to pay the application fee itself. You don't have to do that right away. I'll show you that in a little while. You can submit your application. You pay the fee later on. Okay, I'm going to move on to the next slide. And then finally, there's the examination. What you have to do is sit down and take the test. It's a globally administered test. I'll say that it's the same test, but what happens is it's sort of generated on the fly. So this being June 2nd, 2011, so if I'm right outside of Boston, the test I take right outside of Boston will be somewhat similar to the test that's taken down in Dallas. Tim, I think you said you were down in Dallas somewhere, down there in Texas. So the test you take is going to be somewhat similar. There might be a few questions different because these are computer-generated. They can change things on the fly if they want. But the tests are going to be roughly similar in similar parts of the world. Now, the test today in Boston might be different than the test today in Ireland or Singapore or China, but they've all got the same base, if you will, and that is from a pool of thousands of questions. They give you 200 questions, and you have 4 hours in order to finish up the test. Now, the little kicker to this whole thing is only 175 of those questions are actually graded. The other 25 questions are pre-test questions. These are questions in training, if you will. And if you want to, you can submit a question for the PMP exam. Anybody can do that. There's a link on their site. So if you want to submit a question, here's what you have to do. But you can submit your own question to the PMI to be included on the test. And on any given exam, 25 of those questions are the pre-test questions. The problem for you is they don't tell you which ones they are. So you have to go through all 200 questions. And as you're going through the test, you know you have to have 175 questions that are real. And one of the things the PMI doesn't tell you anymore, used to, is that you have to get roughly 61% correct. What about the 106 questions? If you ask them what percentage score do I have to have, they won't tell you. They'll say you must be proficient in numerous areas. And because there are the process groups that you must be proficient in, the five process groups. They're not going to tell you the percentage, but it's about 61%. Depends upon how you're doing. There are people who may have scored 65% that have failed because they've done terribly in maybe one or two of the process groups that you have to go through. So you can maybe score higher numerically and still fail the test. You could score maybe lower or right around 61% numerically because you've done a good job across all of the process groups. You're proficient or relatively proficient in the process group, so you got a good base knowledge, so they decided that you're going to pass the test. It used to be pretty well percentage bound when I took the test back in version 2. It isn't so much anymore. So I already mentioned that in some countries the test is paper-based. Let's move on to the next slide and talk about what type of questions you're going to be getting. I mentioned process groups before. There are five process groups to the PMBOK. That's a project management body of knowledge. As you start reading through the PMBOK, you'll find those in the later chapters, 4 through the end of the book, up to the appendix. And what they do is they have a smattering of questions that are related to those process groups. Now, this slide says old PMP exam domain mix. And that is because today and up to the 31st of August, this is the breakdown of questions. You have your five process groups they pull questions from, plus there are explicit questions from the professional and social responsibility piece. Remember that thing I said you have to check off in the application? There are questions from there, directly from there as well. Ethical questions. It's ethical too, and they'll give you four answers. You pick the best one. There are explicit questions. And you see the percentages there, 11% initiating. I'll read them off for those who are driving the car or walking the dog or doing the ironing while you're listening to me here. 11% in initiating, 23% for planning, 27% for executing, 21% for monitoring and controlling, 9% for closing, and 9% for professional and social responsibility. So those percentages add up to the 200 questions. And down the bottom of the slide just is another reminder that only 175 questions are actually scored. Now, August 31st date is important because there was this thing called a role delineation study that was done last year. They do about once every 5 years. And what it does is goes through, looks at the entire process from training to PMI's website to material to building the application to the test itself to recertification. They go through the whole spiel, if you will, and see if everything's still relevant. And sometimes things are relevant, sometimes things are not. If they're not relevant, they're going to change it. And what's happening on August 31st is the exam's going to change. So I'm going to move to the next slide and talk about what's changing in the exam. The only thing that changes on August 31st, the exam is still based on PMBOK version 4. You don't have to worry about that. It'll be on version 4 probably all through 2012 anyway, and most likely through most of 2013. So if you're just getting ready to start off, you still have plenty of time. So don't worry about that so much. What we do have to worry about is if you're right on the cusp of getting ready to take the test. Because after August 31st, the mix of questions changes. The mix goes from initiating is now 13%, planning is now 24%, executing is 29%, monitoring and controlling is 25%, and closing is 9%. What's missing? Professional and social responsibility is what's been taken off. What this role delineation study found is that professional and social responsibility is so ingrained in everything a project manager does that they felt it was no longer relevant to ask separate explicit questions on that area. So what they've done is they're still going to see ethical questions, but they're going to be merged in. Maybe there'll be an ethics thing for an initiation question or a planning question. They'll give you a scenario and there'll be an ethical bent to what they're asking, and that's how they're covering the professional and social responsibility area on the test after August 31st. So you've got some figuring to do. If you think you're going to be testing soon, here we are recording this session on the 2nd of June, you basically have 3 months to get going. If you're almost ready to pull the trigger and actually take the test, great for you. Do it soon so that all the material that you've built up, you probably have study guides, you probably have practice tests, whatever. Those are all on the old style. So any of the questions on social and professional responsibility are still relevant. Those professional and social responsibility questions can still be asked. So it's still good stuff. After August 31st, well, not so much. That you're going to have to maybe find some new material out there. Now, that being said, you can still study from all the old stuff. You just have to be aware that there's not going to be questions on, explicitly on professional and social responsibility. So if you're going to test after August 31st, you know, it's not a humongous problem. It's just the questions are going to be a little bit different. The knowledge still has to be up there in the old cranium, up in those old gray cells, for you to pare it back out. So don't worry about it so much. It will be different. So if you've practiced on pre-August 31st stuff and you're testing after August 31st, it may look a little different, but the same basic stuff is there. It's still PMBOK version 4 is the point. Okay, so I'm going to move on to the next slide. And now we're going to talk about how to get ready for the exam itself. Okay, you've got to take some steps to get ready to prepare for the exam. Well, one, you have to get some courses out of the way. You need to get that 35 direct hours somehow. I'll give you some recommendations for that in a little bit. But get your 35 hours in. Now, this 35 hours isn't 35 hours in the last year. If you have had some project management classes in your college career or something that could be construed as a project management class, that could count. And if you graduated 10 years ago, it still counts. 15 years ago, it still counts. There's no statute of limitations, if you will, on training. So don't worry about that so much if any of your older college classes might work out for you. Now, unless if you've gone to school for a project management degree, which have only been around for the past 4 or 5 years anyway, for the most part, chances are your double E degree or your business degree is not going to cover you so well. Your electrical engineering or your business degree is not going to cover you so well. So chances are some of your older college classes will not be germane, so you shouldn't mess with them. But if your company's paying for your PMP, get them to sign you up for a project management certificate. See if they'll do that for you. That'll give you that same 165 hours that I was talking about, if you will. Most of those are 3, 4, or 5 classes, depending upon the organization. And if it's 30 hours per, there's 150 hours right there that you could use. If you're paying for these yourself, then I have other choices for you. You can still do these if you want to spend the money, but I have some other things that I'll tell you about in a little bit. But you need the core courses to prepare for the exam, and then you need study time. You're going to have to live with your material for a while. How long is a while? Folks tell me they take anywhere from 2 months to a year to do this, with the average being 3 to 4 months. That's why you see 80 to 100 hours there. This is going to be study time. You're going to have the PMBOK. Either you've gone out and bought a hard copy of it, or you've printed out the version you'll get for free when you join the PMI, or you're going to have an online version that you get from joining the PMI, whatever. But you're going to have the PMBOK. You should find some study guide to use. There's a wealth of them out there. I'll give you 2 pointers now. Everybody loves Rita Mulcahy's material. You can certainly use that. There's plenty of it out there. A lot of it's been handed down. All that stuff is perfectly valid. There's Andy Crow stuff out there. There's a whole bunch of others. In the PM Lessons Learned Monthly PMP Exam Study Group that I run, I use Kim Heldman's study guide, version 4 study guide, the 5th edition, put out by John Wiley and Sons. That's a very good value. It's $40 to $60 U.S. It's the study guide itself. It's got a lot of practice questions in it, review questions. It's got paper tests in it. It's got a CD on it with a computer-based engine for computer-based tests. It's got audio in it. And a goodly number. You need 2 hands and more to count the number of study guides out there that are roughly similar. What's different is the content, the style that they present the material in. So talk with some of your friends who are PMPs or some other PMPs. Find out what they use. Find out what they liked, what they didn't like. Settle on one. I don't care which one you use, but use one or two as a study guide because you're going to need it. And then use those practice tests, and I'll talk about those in a little while as well. If you can get into a study group, that's a great thing as well. Either this one here that you're on right now, although this one is not as interactive as a lot of study groups are, because I'm trying to do this more as a lecture series. But if you're looking for one and you can't find one, as I mentioned at the beginning of this call, we have a weekly virtual PM Lessons Learned PMP exam study group that uses the free C room. It uses the same number that you dialed in for this call. And David Radkovich runs a weekly PM Lessons Learned PMP exam study group. With that one, you're going to have to present material. It's going to be a very interactive call. He'll have anywhere from 10 to 20 people on the call. It's very popular. It's free, too. The price is right. We're all volunteers here. We'll make recommendations for things you need to spend money for, perhaps, but you don't have to pay anything for our services, for what we provide you. But find a study group. If you're in a certain area, maybe you can find a face-to-face study group. Judy and some of the other folks who were on, and you're from New Jersey, come to this call from a face-to-face study group that's there in New Jersey. And there's plenty of those study groups around the world. Your local chapter will have study groups from time to time, as well as they'll have PM prep classes as well that you can use up in the contact hours. Knowledge thing as well. Your local chapter will tend to be more reasonably priced for a PMP prep class than will a for-profit educational organization. But the stuff is there. You can use it. And that study group will provide you that color commentary. You'll be able to interact with individuals and get a whole lot more out of the material, I think, if there are a whole lot more opinions out there. You can play devil's advocate with each other and such. And then do what you can to find a bunch of sample questions, study aids and tools. As I said in the beginning of this call, the Internet's a very big place. There's plenty of that stuff out there. You'll see a few slides at the end of this deck with some recommendations for your places to go to get that stuff, okay? And then there's a PMP exam prep course. If you can take one, you can do that. You don't need one. It's recommended that you do if you're not so sure about things, but you don't really need one. If you can afford it and want to do it, fantastic. It gives you that much more confidence going into the test. And as you're sitting through things, the bottom point down there, schedule the exam within 6 months of a validated application. And the reason why we say that is if you wait till more than 6 months after you submitted your application, you could be audited when you finally pay the money. When you submit your application, and that's when your one-year eligibility period starts, and you've got a year to take the test 3 times. You're not paying for the exam. You're only submitting the application, and they're accepting it. At some point in time when you're ready to go, Now you're going to request that you're going to take the exam. You're going to pay your money. That you'll see how much that is in a moment. If you wait beyond the six-month interval, you'll still be fine, but they might trigger you. More people are audited if they wait more than 6 months to pay for the exam than if they do it before the six-month period. Now, the good news of that is if you're not sure something's come up personally, your stuff happens. We're human. You have all grand plans to study and get rocking and rolling in those first 3 months. You submitted your application, and you paid for the exam, and you're in your one-year period, and something happens. You know, people get sick, you change jobs, whatever the case may be. And now you find yourself 1 month left, or 5 months left, 4 months left to your one-year period. This might be a good thing, because if you submit your payment and it's beyond 6 months and you get audited, that'll turn in your favor, because if you are audited, and it's pain going through auditing, but the good part about auditing is when you're audited, you get another whole year to take the test. So to be aware of that, that's an unwritten thing that we've identified over the years, because we talk to people and we find, well, yeah, I had a month left before my year expired and I paid my money. Oh, didn't I get audited? And then find out, oh, they get another whole year. So it's a pretty good deal. Moving on to the next slide. We're getting into a timeline now to give you an idea of what's going on. So basically, there's a two-step timeline here because it was too long to put on one line. So the top line, the yellow portion is the first thing you want to do is build your direct hours, because there's no time limit to that. Get them out of the way. Figure out, yeah, I'm going to do this if your company will pay for you to enroll in a project management certificate course. Fantastic. If they'll pay for a three-day, a two-day project management course, fantastic. Just take those whenever. You know you're going to be going through this exam eventually, but get those out of the way. Get them done. Build up your direct hours. Get those, because those can take a while to do, and there's no statute of limitations on them, which is great. But get those out of the way. Start anytime you want, and that's the yellow area. For those who are driving the car or walking the dog, I've got a yellow area on the front of the timeline. It happens to be 3 months in this example, but the length is immaterial. It can be any amount of time you want. But this is basically sort of from the time you decided to get going. So I plugged in 3 months. Pick your time. And then after that's over, now you've got all your direct hours or most of your direct hours, and now you want to start in earnest, if you will. Start really paying attention and buckling down and getting into study mode. So the next piece of this timeline is colored orange. It's roughly 5 months, I think, on here. 4 months on here. But it can be as long as you need it to be. It can be 1 month. It could be 6 months. It can be a year. It doesn't matter. For this one, I chose 4 months. So you made your decision to start. We trip into the orange area. At some point in time in that study mode time, you're walking around with your study guides all the time. You're walking around with your material. You've downloaded all the PM Lessons Learned Monthly PMP Exam podcast. And you're studying. You're building up your critical mass. At some point into that, when you think you're getting close to the point where you're going to be submitting your application, also in this time you're actually building all the stuff for your application as well. You're building that text document, that Word file, that whatever file that has all of your hours and your project descriptions. You're working on that too, getting that going. So at some point in time, a month or two or three in, now you're going to join the PMI. You want to join the PMI because it's cheaper to take the test when you join the PMI. They want to make it worth your while. They want to bait you, if you will. PMI is in this to make money. They're not in this to be nice people. They're in this to make money, and sure, they want to progress their profession for sure, but they're not in it for the goodness of their souls like some organizations are. They're in it to make money. So they want you to join. They want you so you'll re-up next time you have a one-year membership. So join the PMI. Also join a local chapter. Why? Because you can go to local chapter meetings. You can network with people. You can participate more easily in some of their courses that they give them. Most of the local chapters actually do PMP exam prep classes. They do a lot of other things. And once you've actually passed a test, you can garner PDUs from your local chapter pretty easily. Do a lot of networking there as well. So you're going to join the PMI in your local chapter, and that's out of the way. And now the next point there is another month or so down the road. You're going to make the decision to complete the application, get everything with the application ready to go, and you're actually going to start building it. You can build your application, and it can live inside the PMI's website for up to a year. You don't have to do it all in one day. You can do it in bits and pieces over some period of time. So that decision to start on the timeline toward the end of the orange period, maybe 1 month left to go, is you're going to start building your application, okay? So we get that going. And then finally, And also while you're doing this, you're studying, you're working through practice tests and such. You're going to see in a couple of slides, I'm going to give you a methodology to use paper practice tests for a while and then switch to online tests. This is all in study mode. So when you've made the decision, you're joining the PMI and such, you're taking practice paper tests. And first you start off, you're getting 30%, 40%. Well, that's not so good, but you're still building your mass, your critical mass. You're looking to see, where do I have to improve? You're checking yourself. And over time, those numbers are going to go up. Well, at some point in time, you're going to be scoring very well on the paper. That's when you move over to brand new, fresh material on the online test. The online tests are better at the end because they tend to give you your score right away. You don't have to score them for yourself. And they'll give you an idea of where you are. So somewhere between that make the decision to start, that last month or so, or last couple of weeks, between the time you started the online practice test, that decision to start, and submit application, is when you're really moving fast with online practice tests, and you're scoring yourself. You start maybe with 60% on the online test, because the questions are different. You're not starting down to 30% because you have that critical mass. Okay, so now you're starting at 60%, and you're working your way up. And once you hit the 80% level, around 80%, somewhere in there, that's when you're ready to pull the trigger. That's when you should submit your application, and if you want to pay for it right away, you can do that as well. But the point here is you're ready to start that one-year eligibility period. And the way you start that is a two-step process of starting that. One is to submit the application, and then step two is to pay for the test. Now, they can be done at the same time if you want, but they don't have to be. So if you want to submit your application a month before you pay for it, that's fine. You can do that. But you won't receive your eligibility credentials, if you will, until you actually plunk down your money. So work that any way you want. They happen to be both in one milestone here on this timeline, but they don't have to be. So you've submitted your application, you've paid your money. PMI gets back to you within 5 business days. They're very good about getting back to you within 5 business days. So it's okay. You're working these practice tests, you're scoring 80%, 75%, 85%, 80%, 85%. On these practice tests, you pull a trigger, you submit your application, you paid for the test. 5 business days later, you receive your eligibility response in email. Everything's done electronically. It's got a special number in there that you can use with a Prometric Test Center to actually go onto the Prometric website and schedule a test for your area. Okay. Now, depending upon where you live, I live right outside of Boston. I have a half a dozen different test centers that I can get to within an hour's drive from here. Where you live, that may not be the case. Now, you may have to drive for 2 hours to find a test center that only does PMP tests on Tuesdays. You've got to be aware of that as well, especially if you're going to test right around that August 31st date I told you about before. If you're going to try to go with the old style of the test, don't try to schedule a test on August 30th. You may not get in because everybody and their brother are going to be doing the same thing. So schedule early and often for those things. But if you live someplace where you have some level of diversity, if you will, in your test centers, fantastic. So you're going to have your code, you're going to go to the Prometric website, you're going to schedule a time for your test. If you want to do it right away, you can. If you want to sit on it for a while, you can as well. You have 1 year to take the test up to 3 times, and that's on the bottom part of the slide. That's the red part of the timeline. That's a 1 year time slice. There's 1 year eligibility on it. You have 1 year to take the test 3 times. The point on the bottom of the slide, the order of the milestones is important. The timing doesn't matter so much. It doesn't matter if it's 1 month in between two or three things. The only thing that's important is once you pay for your test, you have 1 year to take the exam. And that's the most important part of all this timeline. And then the rest of it is commentary, if you will, on how long it takes you to do things. Your mileage will vary. Some people will go through it very quickly. I've known people who have spent a month doing this. I've known people who spent 3 years doing it, too. So it depends on the way you study and how you assimilate the data and get ready to parrot it back out for the PMI. Okay, let's move on to the next slide. Now, let me start giving you a few tips, things to pay attention to that you'll have to know about as well. This slide here is sort of like a hierarchy of needs. We start down at the bottom. It's got 4 basic points on it, set up in a bit of a hierarchy of needs type of pyramid. I live right outside of Boston, so I'm going to say studying for the exam is wicked hard. It takes time. You have to take some time. You have to walk around with the study guides with you all the time so that you have a little snippet of 15 minutes while you're waiting for a train. You're reading the guide. You're going through practice tests or something along those lines. But anytime you have a chance to sit down and go over some more material, do that. It really is helpful to do that. Next step is when you're ready to think about starting to take practice tests, start with the paper first. Paper test, you have to score them yourself. look what you got right, look what you got wrong, get your percentage down so you know what your score was, and then study the stuff that you need to and just sort of refresh yourself every now and again on the stuff you don't need to so much. And just keep on doing that until you run out of practice tests or you are testing up around 80% on those paper tests. Once you're up to about the 80% level, switch over to your online ones, as I mentioned before, and start doing those. Those can go faster. They tend to be graded for you. They tend to tell you what you need to pay attention to for you. Because now that you're toward the end, you're going to be impatient. You're going to want the instantaneous feedback, if you will. And those come with the online test engine type of thing, be it a CD in your laptop or over the internet to some of the sites that are there as well. But you'll figure out what works for you. But go through it like this, preparing for the test and getting yourself up around the 80% level. Because if your practice tests are around 80% level, practice tests aren't perfect by any means. But if you're scoring 80% on a practice test, chances are you're going to score more than 61% on the real test as well. It'll be a little different, but not hugely so. So pay attention to it that way. I've found that over the years, it's a good way to have things work out. I'm going to move to the next slide. I promised to talk to you about cost, so let's talk about cost now. We've got the timeline stuff out of the way. As I mentioned, you need 35 direct hours. You can spend a whole wide array of money for those direct hours. Since I'm in the U.S., all the financial figures you see here are in U.S. dollars, so you can do your own transfiguring wherever you happen to be. But if you're funding your own PMP certification, the best value to receive that 35 hours that we found so far is at a website that Cornelius Finkter set up called PM PrepCast. For $100, it's $99.97 or something like that. But for $100 U.S., he's going to send you a whole bunch of MP3 and video files. That he's a registered education provider with the PMI, so it's all valid stuff, and you'll get to 35 hours that way for $100 U.S. So that's probably the cheapest way to do it and have it come from a viable resource that you know the PMI is not going to reject if you happen to be audited. Okay? Now, from that point on, you can go higher than that. If you can convince your company, your organization, to fund that project management certificate, those suckers go for $5,000 by the time you're done, sometimes even more, depending on what level you get, what school you're at, or something in the middle, a boot camp, a PMP test prep class can be anywhere from $1,000 to $2,000 for the education providers. I should have put in here, but didn't, but I'll say it now. Remember I mentioned those local chapters? Local chapters tend to do them for, I'm going to throw out, depending upon where in the world you are, $150 to $350, probably more toward the lower end, because they know they're doing this as a service to their membership. So it's going to be on the lower end of that. It's going to be more than the PM PrepCast, but certainly less than a for-profit educational institution. Okay? So you've got that together. Now, so that gives you your direct hours. Then I mentioned joining the PMI. The PMI is $129 for the first year and roughly $20 to join a local chapter. You should join your local chapter and a whole bunch of communities of practice. Those are free. There's 30 or so communities of practice. Join half of them. Once you pass the test in your PMP, they all give webinars, and it's all free PDUs. So you have no excuse not to garner the right number of PDUs to recertify in 3 years if you join a few of these communities. No excuse whatsoever. It's working out very well, I think. So join the PMI and the local chapter and take advantage of that. Then there's the exam. If you are a PMI member, which you should be, the exam is $405. If you're not, it's $555. So there's the difference with the exam fee right there. You might as well join the PMI, take advantage of what they have, check them out, and if you don't like it, then fine. You don't have to re-up. Your PMP certificate is still good, and you can still recertify. It's just going to cost you more because you're not a member to do that. Recertification, I think, is $65 U.S. If you're not a member, I think it's $105 or something like $120. It's over $100 in any case if you're not a member. So you don't have to be a member, but they try to make it worth your while to stay a member. And then finally, the other stuff, all those study guides I was talking about, practice tests and things like that, those are not free. So you'll need to make sure that as time goes on, you spend the right amount of money for what you're trying to do, or your company spends the right amount of money for what you're trying to do. And it could be anywhere from $50 and up. You know, you can spend thousands of dollars if you choose to, just sort of be aware of how much money you're spending there. And if the company funds it, great. So these are all the costs involved in getting the PMP. I'm going to move to the next slide and talk a bit more about scheduling. You need a study plan of some type. So create a schedule, something along those lines that will help you get through things, you know, plan and a schedule, sort of work it like a project. What this is, five different bullet points, if you will, that says follow this progression. Build up a schedule plan, personalize it so that it meets your needs, your time frames, whatever the case may be. Use it as your project plan for making things happen. If you are actually a project manager, maybe you can build this into some of your own projects that you're working on. Things along those lines. So, you know, do whatever you can to have a plan written down so you know where you are, you know, how far along you are on that timeline that I talked about a little bit earlier. Okay, moving on to the next slide. And now I'm going to get into a few hints. Although, actually, let me pause here for 10 seconds in case anybody wants to do a star six, unmute yourself, ask any questions about what I've gone over so far. And if not, I'll carry on and go into study hints and some references to grab stuff from.
Hi, this is Bart.
Hey, Bart. Yeah, go ahead, Bart.
I have a tip. In your study plan, make sure you join some kind of study group. Because what I find is, first of all, it just keeps it more interesting. But just talking the talk, the language and everything, it just kind of gets ingrained in your head and it makes everything easier to flow and understand. Also, you may have some kind of misconceptions on things and somebody will bring up something discussing that topic and it'll just turn you around and you say, oh, okay, I misunderstood that.
Cool.
I thought that's a very, very important piece of studying.
Fantastic point. Yes, do whatever you can. I'll say there are plenty of study groups out there. Certainly if you join the PMI, which you can do toward the front end in that orange period, or even in the yellow period for that matter, your membership goes for a year as well. They'll point you at study groups because they know about them in the area as well. Maybe there's a study group where you work, your company, your organization, whatever the case may be. But yeah, definitely find a face-to-face study group if you can, as Bart said. If you cannot, then come see us at PM Lessons Learned. Join our virtual study group that we have once a week. You do it from the beauty of your home, but you'll still have to do the work, and it'll do all the same things that Bart just mentioned. So it's definitely worthwhile to join that study group. Thanks for that, Bart. Appreciate it. So now let's carry on with other study hints. As we start going through things, you'll find that if you use mnemonics to remember stuff, there's a lot of rote memorization here in this exam. There's a lot of stuff you've got to cram in there. So the use of mnemonics helps out a lot. And if you're not sure what a mnemonic is, it's a way to take a list of things and turn it into something that you can remember. So the five process groups that we talked about earlier, they're implementing, planning, executing, controlling, and closing. Okay, five process groups. If you're a parent, you certainly know syrup of Ipecac. So that if your child swallows something they shouldn't, you get them to vomit. Okay, syrup of Ipecac. Ipecac has those five letters in there. So the mnemonic for what are the process groups is syrup of Ipecac. You can make up your own if you want. If you go in the lobby area of the Free Sea Conference Hall here or up on our website, www.pmlessonslearned.com, I have a brain dump in the tutorial, if you will, that goes with the brain dump. I've got a bunch of mnemonics in there, too. You can make up your own. That means something to you. I like to cook and such, so I have a lot of food-related ones. You might be a woodworker, so you have more woodworking-related ones. It really doesn't matter. Do what you can to use mnemonics. And then figure out where the patterns are. There's going to be a ton of patterns as you go through this. So train yourself to identify, to decipher what those patterns are, and then exploit them. Memorize them somehow. Do whatever you have to do to make sure that things are moving along. You recognize those patterns and use them to your benefit. I've heard some folks like to color code things as well. So if you're one of those folks that like to use colors, then by all means, work out a color coding scheme that works for you. Different color-coded markers for various pieces. It'll help you out. And also for study hints, work on that brain dump. Go grab the brain dump that I talked about. I'm talking about the good connotation of a brain dump, which is where in the 20 minutes that you have from the time you place your butt in the chair at the test center and say, yes, my name is Dana Safford. I'm here for the PMP exam. You have 15 minutes before you have to start the test. There'll be a clock running so that allow you to go through the tutorial within 15 minutes. You can take on a blank sheet of paper and put a whole bunch of stuff down, all the 42 processes, all the formulas, all the behavioral theories, a whole bunch of other stuff inside of 15 minutes. I did it. A whole bunch of other people that we've coached here at PM Lessons Learned have done it as well. You can go get that brain dump up on our website and just train yourself to go through that. That's the rote memory that we're talking about. Okay? So I'm going to move on to the next slide. And more memorization of lists. Because to answer these questions, you're going to have to know all those definitions, the jargon, the terms, the formulas, and all these other lists, knowing there are 5 process groups, 9 knowledge areas, 42 processes, all the various interactions and flow. They've been flowing all over the place. There's a whole bunch of formulas, a couple of dozen formulas that you can pay attention to, a whole bunch of behavioral theories for motivation and things, and conflict management and communications and just all kinds of things. If you have listened to any of the other PM Lessons Learned podcasts that we do here, you know what some of those are. If you haven't yet, go grab those podcasts. You'll learn about all these things, and it'll help you out. There's a ton of things to remember, so do what you can to memorize all of those lists is the point here. Moving on to the next slide. Some of the things the PMI likes to cover, they really are keen on kickoff meetings. There'll be a couple of questions probably on kickoff meetings. Also lessons learned and historical stuff, historical records. They use those for planning, estimating, risk management or whatever. So lessons learned is a really big deal. You'll have to learn about work breakdown structures. They help you make sure the scope is covered, but they also help you figure out scheduling and costs and things like that. But the things people forget about is it also helps you ensure that you get the right scope in there as well. Also, that you don't give anything away for free. Don't introduce benefits that are not in the requirements. If the customer says they don't need it, you don't put it in unless it's part of a negotiation. Maybe you need something back. If you find you could do something very easily that they didn't realize they needed right away, it's not a part of a requirement, but it's really nice to have, you can use that as a negotiating point. All right, so don't put it in there for free. Keep it out. You might think, well, it's not ethical to do that. PMI doesn't care. PMI says you must cover whatever is in this requirements document and not provide anything extra. Why? Because in general, providing that extra stuff adds cost, adds schedule, things along those lines, and you don't want to do it. And they're very big on stakeholders. Make sure your stakeholders are covered all the way through the project. Stakeholders are real important in the front, not so much in the back end and such. Team members need to be involved as well. Try to include them when you can. They have good ideas, as Bart was mentioning. Use them as you can. Your study group members, your team members, all the same stuff. Everyone has different opinions, and you can really take advantage of that stuff. And project managers must be proactive, looking for things that might go awry so that they can take care of it, and also be communicative and make sure that they communicate out both the good news and the bad news as well. Moving on to the next slide. A whole bunch of different key terms to know. I won't read through all of these. I'll read a few of them: constraints, assumptions, expert judgment, lessons learned, the plan, do, act cycle, progressive elaboration, corrective actions, change requests, resource activity matrix, or RAM. That's a good thing to know about. Project charter, scope, statement of work. A whole bunch of different things here on this slide that you should really know. Make sure that you know all of these, plus a whole lot more. This is just giving you a smattering what's going on. Moving on to the next slide. Now, there's going to be patterns to things. The PMP test is big on patterns. You might remember back to your Sesame Street days, be it you or be it your kids, you know, one of these things is not like the other. You're going to see those types of questions here. They're going to ask you things, which of the following responses belongs to scope management or risk management or something along those lines. And they're going to give you qualitative analysis, quantitative analysis, requirements gathering, and pick something else, cost management, you know, which ones don't belong to risk type of thing, or which ones do belong. You know, you get the idea. 3 will and 1 won't, or 3 won't and 1 will is the other way to look at these things. It's matching, it's exceptions, it's identifying the pattern. What are they trying to have you look for? Where might it be in a process group or knowledge area so that you can cover that part as well, because it may differ. The similarity or the dissimilarity may be different depending upon where in the matrix you are of the 9 knowledge areas and the 5 process groups. It could wind up being different. It is a question looking for an input, a tool, a technique, or an output. Certain things are more on the input side. Other things are more on the output side. Certain things are almost always a tool and technique. They're going to try to mess you up. So you want to be able to do that matching and exception identification to help you answer the question correctly. Okay, moving on to the next slide. Now, some of the key words and phrases to pay attention to in the question: best or worst, first or last, belongs to, does not belong to, must or except for, most effective, least effective, first or last, greatest or least, most helpful, least helpful, not including, a key activity of qualitative risk analysis is, and they'll give you a list. A key activity, preferred response for something. These are all things you want to look for that will give you an idea of what they're trying to find. And the question is, they're not always trying to find a positive side of a question. Sometimes they're going to flip it around on you, and they're going to be looking for bad stuff as well, or negative stuff, however you want to look at that. And you have to answer the question correctly. They're going to try to trick you sometimes. And now I'm moving on to the next slide, and I'm not really going to go into detail on the next three slides. These are the resources I was telling you about. So on the Internet, there are a bunch of different places that you can go. Obviously, the very first one I will talk about, and that's www.pmlessonslearned.com. So you can get your study material here. We have monthly and weekly PMP exam study groups. We have best practices. We have whatever. So this is your one-stop shop, if you will, for PMP study. Now, that commercial notwithstanding, there are a bunch of other places to go to as well. So the rest of this slide, and there's two more that give you a whole bunch more places to go look at. Check them out and use them. Most of these have free stuff on them. Others will charge a little bit. Others charge a lot. You'll notice Rita Mulcahy's site is not on here. Not because it's not a good site, but they charge for pretty much everything. You're going to pay a lot of money for Rita Mulcahy's stuff. So if you can borrow it, find a used version someplace, go do that. It's still good stuff, don't get me wrong, but if you're funding this on your own, there are other places to go to than spend $400 for a test engine or something along those lines. Okay, so just be aware of all these are the places that you can go to find things. So looking at the first resource slide now, I'm going to speed through the next two slides. They're just more of the resources, and I'm going to end up on a slide labeled, how do you stay certified? Okay, so now you've passed the test, you've gone through things, and you've passed on the first attempt because you paid attention to us here at pmlessonslearned.com, and you've actually made it through the test. Congratulations. But now what do you got to do? Well, now you have to maintain your certification. And the way you do that is by garnering PDUs. Your certification lasts for 3 years. It expires on the third anniversary of your pass date. So if you were to pass the test today, June 2nd, 2011, your certification will expire on June 3rd, 2014. So on or about the last month or week or two before June 3rd, 2014, you're going to make sure that you have input at least 60 PDUs worth of educational stuff. That's what a PDU is. You sat through a webinar, a training piece. You've read a book. You can actually get 5 PDUs for just doing your project manager job, should you want to. That will be subject to audit a lot. I've done it once or twice. It's worked out. Last time I tried to do it, they wanted to ask a couple of questions. I just said forget about it because I really didn't need it. I had plenty of other PDUs from all the other free stuff going on. There's plenty of, as I mentioned, this communities of practice have free webinars. There's a lot of free virtual stuff going on. Ganhead.com just had PM Expo just a couple of weeks back. The stuff is still valid. Go to Ganhead.com, and for free, you can garner, I think it's close to 20 PDUs for listening to their presentations. It's all for free in a virtual conference setting. There's another one coming up. ESI is coming up with one in the middle of June sometime. So go check out them as well. But you gather these PDUs, and you have to get 60 within a three-year cycle. It's not 20 per year. It's 60 over 3 years. You can garner them all in the last year if you want. Whatever you want to do, you can do them day by day, whatever you want to do. There's no limit to how quickly or how slowly you accrue these things. The good thing is, and they've kept it going since they've revamped the PDU scheme a little bit, is if you have over 60, you don't have to stop at 60. You can put in more. If you're over 60, you can roll over up to 20 PDUs that you've entered in the last year to the next cycle. So if you put them in on a regular basis, I suggest you put them in close to when you get them so you don't forget about them, or at least write down the provider, the date, and the subject, and how many PDUs it was, so that if you're going to batch them once a month, once every 6 months, you get them all in. And anything that is dated in the last year, if you wind up over 60, you can roll over up to 20 PDUs for the next year and get a head start. But PDUs are much easier to garner now than they had been in the past. And you can get them for pretty much anything, courses, service. If you decide to do a presentation for an organization on project management, you can do PDUs for that. I can claim PDUs for doing this presentation right now. I don't because I don't need to. I garner plenty of PDUs from webinars and things like that, but you certainly can. If you're really worried about auditing, the process the PMI has right now, you're going to know within 10 minutes whether they're going to accept your PDU or not. You submit the PDU on the online system, and 10 minutes later, you receive an email, accepted for the most part, especially if it comes from a PMI registered education provider or any of the communities of practice. 10 minutes later, you'll receive the acceptance. No auditing required. So they're really easy to do. And how do you enter all that stuff? That's the bottom thing down there. They'll keep track of it for you, if you will. You have to keep track of it on a piece of paper or something until you submit it. Once you submit it, they'll keep track of the total for you. That's the URL to go to that you see down there, ccrs.pmi.org. And just put them in, and they keep a running tally. They'll let you know when you're about to expire. Also, if you put in like 60 in the first year, you'll start receiving dunning messages. You've got your 60 PDUs. You want to recertify? Your answer is no, I'm going to wait my 3 years, but you're going to every now and again receive that dunning message. You're ready to rock and roll, but don't. There's absolutely no motivation to do it ahead of time. Do it 2 years early, so just be aware of that as well. And that, as the saying goes, is that. So, okay, I've unmuted everybody's line. So are there any questions out there around the PMP certification process?
This is Judy. If you teach on a paid basis, do you earn PDUs too?
Yes, absolutely.
Oh.
Doing any type of thing, you can earn a PDU. Now, if you're teaching on a paid basis, you can also garner PDUs on all the stuff that I just talked about. So you really don't need to submit that. You can if you want. If you want, there's no extra credit anymore for submitting in that category, I don't think. It's just that you don't garner the PDUs at the same rate. In Category A, with the scheme they have now, a one-hour webinar, a one-hour class is one PDU.
Mm-hmm.
If you're developing a presentation, I think it's five PDUs for the presentation, whether you took an hour to build it or whether you took a year to build it. So it's not a linear type of thing is one way to say it. But, yeah, you can certainly, for what I'm doing right now, you can consider this teaching. I'm not being paid for it. But if I was, you know, I could submit PDUs for this. When I first got my PMP, I taught a couple of classes for work. You know, I was paid for that, but part of my job. I wasn't paid by the students, but HB paid me for them. And I submitted those, and they accepted it.
After how do you determine how many PDUs?
They tell you right in the category. Just look at the handbook, and they tell you. I know just for doing your job, you can get up to five PDUs per year just for doing your project management job. They will ask you for a justification, why do you think that is? And a couple of times I did that when PDUs were not as easy to garner back in 2004, 2005, around there someplace. The webinars weren't as prevalent as they are now. So I took the time to do those. And they audited me once, but they approved it, and they accepted the second one that I did. But I did one just for grins 2 years ago. They didn't accept it, so they wanted to audit me, and they said, forget about it. I don't need it. It's not worth the hassle. So that's my story. I'm sticking to it. So you don't really need to do it. You certainly can. Any other questions out there? Thanks, Judy, for that.
That's great. Thank you.
Okay. I heard somebody out there. Who's next?
Yeah, this is Mir.
Hey, Mir.
The slide number 21 says decipher repeated patterns, identify and exploit. What that means, exploit, though?
So in this case, when you identify in a question there's a pattern going on, what you really want to do is take advantage of that fact. So if, in this case, exploit means to take advantage of the fact that you figured out the pattern and can use that to determine the correct answer. Probably could have chosen a different word, but that works out relatively well. So if you understand the pattern, you can figure out what the real answer is going to be. Because with a lot of the certification tests, what you'll find is of the four answers they give you, one might be a total outlier. Then you can cross that one off right away. You're not going to use that one. And then the other three will probably be some semblance of correct. Now, what you have to do is choose the most correct one of those three, or maybe of those two. Maybe you get two outliers. You want to try to eliminate as much as you can, but typically you're going to be down to picking between one of two answers. So if you can understand the pattern that they're looking for, you can exploit that and zero in on the correct answer a whole lot more easily than if you don't recognize there's actually a pattern there or something that they're trying to do. Which of these is not like the other type of thing? Because sometimes it's not very blatant, if you will.
Okay. Thank you.
Sure. Any other questions out there?
Hi, this is Suresh. Suppose if I pay the fees for the exam and suddenly I'm from India, so suddenly my project ends and I need to go back to India.
Mm-hmm.
So what happens? Can I take the exam from India or not?
Absolutely, sir. Yes, you certainly can, Suresh. Yes, so you can take it anywhere in the world. Depending upon where you're going to, you might be relegated to a paper test. I'm sure there's plenty of places, depending on where you are. In Mumbai, I'm sure there's plenty of online centers. Bangalore, you might have to take a paper test, but certainly you could be anywhere in the world and go through this process. You can certainly take it back to India or any other place you happen to be. If you happen to be on a temporary assignment, say, in maybe like Abu Dhabi shooting or someplace like that, you could take it there. Right?
Okay. And also one more question, like you mentioned three times I can take the exam, right?
Yes.
In a year. That means only one time I need to pay the fees or?
So the answer is no. You have to pay for every single time you take the test. The first time you take the test, the fee is $405. That'll cover the very first time. Now, if you did not listen to PM Lessons Learned and you did not pass on the first attempt, you have two more tries within the year to take that exam. So when you're ready to go again, you will pay an additional fee of $275 U.S. if you are a member. And if you are not a member of the PMI, it's $375 U.S. And you do that two more times. It's the same fee for the second and the third attempt. And so it's paying a fee for every single attempt that you test.
You will receive a new authorization code for the test each time you pay a fee.
If you did not pass, you'll receive a printout that tells you what areas you were proficient in and which areas you were not proficient in. Obviously, you want to go back to your practice tests, and you want to restudy those and then resubmit again. You have to pay for the second and third attempts. So there is the money to be paid on those, yes.
Okay. No.
What if I never took the exam?
If you never took the exam, then then you pay all over again.
Yeah, you lost
the same?
It. You lost it. The same thing. If you never took the exam, in other words, if you paid your $405 and you have your 1 year to take the test and you never did, then I'd say that money is sunk. You know, that's gone. You're going to have to resubmit all over again since you never made any attempts at the test. I think you'll be okay to resubmit. There'll be no cooling off period, anything along those lines, but that $405 initial dollars is sunk, and I'd hazard a guess that when you go do your next application, it's going to be yet another $405 because it's not really a reexamination. So the reexamination fees that I mentioned earlier, what, $275 and $375 U.S., depending on if you are a member, don't apply here because you never sat the first time. So you have first $405 is sunk, and you have to pay an additional $405 all over again.
But will I pay the reduced charge for having, failed it?
No. That $405 is for the first attempt. If you never do the first attempt, that money is sunk. It's gone.
So I still have to pay the $405?
I think so. I believe that is the case.
And not treat it as if I failed the first time?
I think that is the correct way to state that. Yes. Anybody disagree?
Okay.
Who's been through this?
Yeah, I mean, I did last year, especially with ITIL, and I didn't take it, and then I lost the day I tried to postpone. But with the PMP, my friend went through the same thing. He took once, he failed it, but he had 12 months to go for the two other attempts. He never did, and then he lost it. So the next year, then he has to register all over again.
Register again, it's $405, new application, everything else. You resubmit the whole thing all over again.
So I take three exams in a year, so that time if I get a pass, no need to pay the money, right?
Correct. But because you're listening to these podcasts, you're going to pass on the first attempt, so you're all set. But if for some reason you only listen to this one podcast and not all the rest of them, there's a possibility that you might have an issue because you didn't study or whatever the case may be.
No, you in the session you mentioned I may get more percentage, but one area I may be weak, so
yes.
I may get fail.
You might fail, correct. But I think you'd have to be weak in more than a single area. in order to fail. The last few folks I've talked to, HP is a big company, and I don't do all study groups for HP, so I connect in and talk to people and folks outside of HP. And most of the time, if someone fails the test, they are not proficient in at least two areas, if not three. I've seen nobody who's failed the test was only not proficient in one area.
So to submit the application, no need to pay the fees, right? I can submit the application now.
Correct.
But I need to have the contact hours.
You need to have the contact hours and all the experience all in your application in order to submit it. And check the box for professional and social responsibility. And then you can submit your application online, and they'll say, yes, we accept your application. We'll let you know if you're audited. And normally, that'll take 5 business days. So within 5 business days, you'll receive an email back saying, we accept your application. Thank you very much. Now, when you're ready, you can submit your application fee. Or the email will say, we've received your application. You are being audited. Please, here's the audit process. So within 5 business days, you'll receive the one or the other of those two emails. And then you work through things. So at some point in time, if you've received the first letter saying you're all set to go, then it's just a matter of you studying and being ready. Do the paper test first, then the online test, and you're getting close. As soon as you're starting to get close, or maybe when you're starting to do the online test and you know you're going to be focusing time on this, then I would go ahead and submit the test fee itself so that you have the approval letter and the code you need for the test center.
So that means before I submit the application, I should be a member, right? PMI member?
If you're planning to be a PMI member, yes. You'd be good to do that, because then when you go to pay the examination fee, you know you'll be paying the member price of $405 and not the non-member price of $555 U.S.
Oh, okay.
That's what that timeline slide was all about. So on slide 17 of this presentation, in that orange area of study mode, you could join the PMI in the chapter, and where it says make decision to start, you can submit your application for that, or you can submit your application and pay the fee at the same time at the end of the orange area. I probably should have done that a little bit differently. The key for tripping from the orange area to the red area is paying you money. Just remember, the PMI is in this to make money. So that's the main key, is to submit your money, and then you've got your year of eligibility. You receive yet another email back within 5 business days. Normally it's even faster than that. That'll have an eligibility code. And with that code, you can go to the Prometric site, which is www.prometric.com or www.2test.com. And online, you can tell them where you are, and you can pick a test center and what tests you want to take, and they'll tell you what availability they have. Now, some centers are bigger than others. Some have multiple seats for the PMP test. Some only have one, and the test is 4 hours long, so they'll tend to do a morning edition, an afternoon edition. Sometimes centers are open at night, so there'll maybe be an evening edition or maybe a weekend edition, depending upon how open they are. But depending on how many people are signed up for the test, you might not see availability when you want it, especially around August 31st. With this change coming, there'll be a lot of people testing in that last, probably the last half of August, because they want to test on the current version of the exam. So seats in some of these smaller test centers will be harder to get around those time frames. That's the way the process goes. Join the PMI, then submit your application, and then pay your money. And if you want to do the last two together, you can do that. They give you the option to do that, or you don't have to. It depends on what you want to do.
Thanks a lot for information.
Oh, no problem.
Thank you.
Any other questions out there? Okay, hearing nothing. So, okay, that's it for this session of the PM Lessons Learned Monthly PMP Exam Study Group Conference Call and Podcast. As a reminder, PM Lessons Learned conducts 3 conference calls each month. This is the PMP Exam Study Group Call and Podcast that we're on right now. It's the first Thursday of the month. On the second Thursday of each month, we have our PM Lessons Learned Job Shop Call for folks in transition or with a need to identify potential career paths could go to help each other out. And finally, on the third Thursday of each month, we hold our PM Lessons Learned Best Practices Conference Call, where this call provides presentations on a wide variety of project management skills and topics and such. I'll again thank the live participants on this call and everyone that downloads the podcast. Speaking of the podcast, the past 2 years I've been doing the sessions, you folks have downloaded over 20,000 downloads of this monthly PMP Exam Study Group podcast. So I really thank you very much for all that support. It's just awesome. So I'll remind you that we are PMLessonsLearned.com, project managers helping project managers to make a difference. My name is Dana Safford. So long and keep on learning.
This has been a PM Lessons Learned podcast. Project managers helping project managers by sharing lessons learned. Come join our group. Visit our website at PMLessonsLearned.com. Till next time, keep on learning.